Good morning. It is Monday, the 22nd.
Or 3rd.
And 23rd. We're the education.
23rd?
Yes. I'm losing track. And we're the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. And tomorrow, we get to pass on the K-12 budget.
And Mr. Unless, Co-Chair?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair.
I did spend time with LRO and with the department on last Friday and to talk about the numbers that we have. So if you want me to give a brief report tomorrow, I can.
Okay. Should we do that tomorrow or you want to do it today?
Oh, I don't have my paperwork here today. So
and the state economist?
State economist,
as
yes.
Well.
We'll
yes.
Do it tomorrow. Okay, Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, real briefly, you have in front of you a large document that has green on it, and it's two-sided. And this document is an attempt to show you a comparison between the current budget, the CSL, current service level, and what the governor proposed. Part of it is mainly to show you where the governor differs significantly from current service level and made quite a bit of new investments into the various grant and aid programs. So the first few lines there at the top are just sort of the operations, the school for the deaf, youth corrections, and debt related. I just put those there for reference sake. This only shows general fund and other sort of state controlled funds like lottery, tobacco master settlement agreement funds, which are used for FIA or the physical education grants, and the amount that comes for the network for quality learning and teaching that comes from a carve out from the state school fund. So real briefly, and I don't want to go through this line by line because I promised Mr. Cannon that he could get going as soon as possible, but the those listed in green or the bars and greens are those programs that were proposed in the governor's budget as new programs or as significantly increased programs. And then the far right column is just the difference between the CSL and the governor's budget. And then to put this in perspective, the co-chair's budget is based on that 15-17 CSL plus the $60 million. So that's the resources you have. There may be a little more resource coming from some backfill of the network, but at this point, think of that as $60 million plus that middle column. And the only difference that the co-chairs did in any kind of detail on this page is if you turn to the back, there's one with a yellow line. That is the long-term care programs. The co-chair's framework added $3 million to that program on top. So that's the only other difference between CSL and the co-chair's budget or framework. So on the first page, there's mainly the what I'll call the K through 12 grant and aids. And on the back page is pretty much early learning and youth development. And then at the top of the second page is what, for a lack of better term, I call special education and population-specific programs. And a lot of those are the special ed and early childhood special education and those things. So if you have questions or want to talk about this, please come and see me. I don't want to spend too much more time on this, but you can see at the bottom of the second page that the governor's budget, the difference column, adds up to $219 million. You have $60 million at this point. So that will just put things in perspective.
So Representative Huffman, 219 into 60. Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chair, can you clarify then for me again exactly what we will be doing tomorrow?
We will be voting on the co-chair's recommendation of $7.255 billion for the K-12 budget.
And, Mr. Chair, just to clarify, there is the thing that's missing is the state school fund. It is not part of this sheet.
Okay.
So I left that off not to do any confusion on dollars.
So, Mr. Chair, so we won't be doing the grant and aid $60 million area that will still be up for. Okay.
That'll be later.
And I'm sure, Mr. Chair, you'll want to spend some time in some of these areas in much more detail as part of phase two.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Doug, just for an example, and this is the only question I'm going to ask. So, like, in the educator effectiveness grouping, there's like 0.33, 0.59. So we allocated certain dollars for programs, and then the department broke it down into these those percentages, or
actually, Madam Chair, in most cases,
or is that what we
the
did?
Legislature, as part of the work session and the assumptions made, actually split a lot of that out itself programs, and the main reason you don't see those funded in current service level. Are that, keep in mind, you lost roughly $11 to $12 million in the network funding because you had one-time funding in 13-15 coming from the Common School Fund, and that is no longer available.
You sure we didn't do a two-time? Never mind.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. Doug, thank you very much. This was a tremendous amount of work, but it's going to be very helpful for me.
I need to help or thank the department also, so we made sure our numbers balanced with each other.
Good. Well, thank you. And Mr. Chair, then, and Doug, is this available for folks to be able to look at that are dealing with early learning? And part of the $219 million folks out there, is this available for them to be able to look at? And
it was posted this morning on today's meeting agenda on OLIS.
Okay.
So it's out there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 5024 and ask for Mr. Cannon to come forward.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of our Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'm very glad to be kicking off what will be several weeks of presentation from the HEC and representatives of the commission, from our universities and colleges, from OHSU, from those who are interested in our student financial aid and access programs. We'll have public testimony interspersed, and I'll show you sort of a proposed schedule that we've worked out with Doug and the co-chairs for that time in a moment. I am going to jump in by first drawing your attention to our commission chair's letter. Hopefully you've received a letter, I think it's on OLIS, that was submitted to the committee by Tim Nesbitt, chair of the commission, who hoped to be here and was here last week to share some introductory remarks with you. Instead of getting those in person, you've got them in writing. And I just wanted to read a couple of sentences from that letter that can help frame our conversations over the next few weeks. He writes, "As you know, the HEC is a coordinating commission, not a governing board. As such, we seek to steer and cheer rather than regulate and manage the operations of our colleges and universities. By steering well, we can enable our institutions to do their best work and our students to make the most efficient way possible to rewarding careers and productive citizenship. Our cheering, in turn, will celebrate the success of our students and institutions, and we hope build public support for greater investment in education beyond high school. To these ends, we are pleased to be able to say that what you have put in place is working. We've made great progress in our first 2 years in developing a short-term action plan and framing long-term strategies to advance student access and success and improve institutional capacity and efficiency. Notably, we have not found it necessary to come back to you in this session for any new authorities or any major modifications of the tools you have given us." As a new agency, preparation for this budget presentation isn't merely about and hasn't merely about been presenting budget recommendations and requests. It's also been, in part, an exercise in defining who we are, what we do, how we work with each other as staff, with you, at the legislature, with our institutions. What you will see in some respects, including in our opening remarks today, will be different from what and how the higher education budget recommendations have been presented in the past. We have a comprehensive responsibility for higher education, and that will be reflected in the upcoming days. Our role, as I've tried to define it for staff relative to the legislature, is primarily to clarify for you the options and choices that you have relative to investments in higher education. You make the decisions. We can, at our best, really clarify what the impacts of those decisions, greater or lesser levels of funding, greater or lesser levels between different sectors of higher education, what the impacts of those choices would be. You have our commission's, you will have our commission's best thinking in terms of recommendations for those funding, those difficult funding decisions, but ultimately, of course, those are yours to make.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just something for everybody here that we talked about Friday afternoon in Capitol Construction that I think we're going to have to figure out is the bonding for universities and how, you know, what Ben said does differ from what it was with OUS. And so as we work through that, you know, kind of keep that in mind and how we're going to be figuring out that relationship with the universities and how much the treasurer's involved or whatever.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure we'll be coming back to that point. Before I jump into the slides, I just want to introduce or draw your attention to a few of the folks on our staff who will be participating or who have helped to support the development of this presentation, many of whom you know. Jim Middleton, our interim commissioner at Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Bob Brew, the executive director of our Office of Student Access and Completion. You know Dana Richardson, our legislative and policy director. Cheryl Myers, our chief of staff. Dave Zerbe, who leads operations at CCWD, and ultimately we expect for the hack, and Endi Hartigan on our communications staff, who's helped really spearhead the putting together of this presentation. So we look forward to following up, as ODE and other agencies have done, to your questions and comments and concerns, and we'll endeavor to do as good a job as they did in getting back to you quickly, but please let us know how we can support your important work. So let me jump right in. This is the schedule. We're starting later than we expected, but we still understand ourselves to have roughly the amount of time that our combined agencies have in previous sessions. So while this looks long, it doesn't really add to the amount of time that colleges, universities, student aid and access, private, post-secondary had in previous years. This slide for us has been useful in part because it helps to describe the organization of our agency, and we'll be coming back to that in the final day, day 16, where we really hone in on our sort of agency staffing, not merely sort of our support for institutions and affordability. There may be some tweaks, obviously, as we go. We've already adjusted to try to find some additional time. We're looking at combining days 3 and 4, and moving things around to suit your schedule and the needs of our institutions. You'll see reflected in the table of contents here a high degree of collaboration with the institutions. You will hear directly from community colleges and their representatives, from public universities and their representatives, from OHSU and its president. The color coding reflects our offices or emerging offices under the HEC umbrella, and you can see the various sort of kinds of responsibilities that they have. And again, we'll come back to that organizational structure in much more detail on what's listed here as day 16.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
Just to have a reference for everybody out there watching and listening, I think it's really important that people understand how long you've been working on this process. So if you could, when you, as you present, say, well, we've been working on this for 3 months now, people I mean, the amount of work that has been accomplished in, what, the last 2 years is really phenomenal, and I don't think our public or some of us even realize the depth and hours that you've put into all this, so.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, thank you. I think one way of illustrating is to say a year ago at this time, the HAC, the sort of folks who had responsibility for the comprehensive nature of this slide and others you will see existed of at a staffing level, myself and one or two others. It still doesn't exist of many more folks than that, but we have had the opportunity to hire some, and we have been able to interconnect these offices in a much more holistic way, and I hope that's reflected going forward. Thank you. So today that is really an overview of the work. We'll try to focus on sort of about the first 30 or 40 slides here and not too much more than that. Spend a little bit of time talking about the state's higher education goals and our progress towards those. I'll provide an overview of our budget recommendations and priorities. Talk about the governance structure, so a little bit of what we just saw, this new role for the HEC, a new relationship with some of the institutions to the state. Talk a little about the HEC's work around equity and some of the demographic trends underway in Oregon, and conclude with some discussion of the return on investment for investments in higher education. And John DePagna from Echo Northwest and Greg Hammond from Lynn Benton Community College will help to amplify some of the work that the commission has done to promote the idea that investing in higher education produces a significant return for the individual as well as for the public. I don't need to belabor our state goal. You know it, but here it is. It does help. I shouldn't merely say it helps frame the work. It really does frame the work for the commission. When the new commission met for the first time in late 2013, this is where we began. And the strategic plan that the commission adopted, that's reflected in these budget recommendations, really is organized around our state's 40-40-20 goal. It is an ambitious one. One of the ways in which I've been both inspired but also daunted in some respects by the work that I've gotten myself into is to get to know other states and their goals and come to find that ours is especially aggressive. And that's something to be proud of and not something to be cowed by, but it is worth noting the ambitiousness of Oregon's goal with respect to higher education and education generally. One of the challenges inherent in the goal is a sort of definitional one. Who's it for? When we say 40-40-20, about which Oregonians are we describing? Some of the work that the OEIB and the HEC and staff started doing over a year ago was an attempt to better wrestle with the question of whether 40-40-20 was a goal for the entire adult population, some subset of the adult population, or sort of the pipeline of today's second graders, if you will, the high school class of 2025. Of course, we start with the statute, which says quite clearly it isn't a goal for all adult Oregonians by the year 2025. At the same time, I think the OEIB and the HEC and staff believe that required some additional refinement and understanding, some unpacking. And so what this slide attempts to represent is the way in which we've begun to distinguish between 40-40-20, yes, as a goal for the entire adult population, and also a goal for the pipeline, with some refinements between the two. And so for the pipeline, yes, it is the expected high school class of 2025. And for the adult population, it really probably means the working age population in 2025. And we have begun to think of that really as adults between the ages of 25 and 64. And the final bullet here really describes that latter goal, that adult population goal, is one that should be continually refined, if not by the legislature, then certainly by boards and commissions, to ensure that it continues to really drive value for adult Oregonians. And that means looking at the labor market and whether those certificates and degrees that we're promoting for adult working age Oregonians have value in an economic sense. So let's look now at our progress towards that goal. So here it is, represented as the bachelor's degree in that top 40, the associate's degree, certificate, apprenticeship in the middle 40, and then the high school completion as the 20. When we look at our entire working age adult population, and this is 2013 data, we see what you see, that we're at about 31% on bachelor's degree or higher. We estimate about 17% of associate's degrees or certificates, an estimate because we don't keep as a state close track of certificate counts, and neither is it measured by census data, which is the best, which is the way that we've captured this adult population. But we do think, based on some research, that it's probably at about 17% for the middle 40. And then a whole bunch of folks who have not earned an associate's degree, certificate, or bachelor's degree, but have completed high school, and then that final 10% of our adults who report not having completed high school. I want to note that Oregon is average. I'll just put it that way, in practically every respect relative to a higher education attainment levels. There's one way in which we're not average, and we'll come back to this, and it's a theme that Chair Nesbitt's letter brings forward too. We're not average in the sense that we have much higher numbers of Oregonians, adult Oregonians, who have attended college but not completed certificate or degree than other states. In fact, we're number 6 in the country for the percentage of 25 to 64 year olds who report having some college but not completed. I'll come back to that in just a moment. Let me first look at the high school class of 2006. This gets really stark. So now we're talking about the pipeline. These are students who we have tracked longitudinally since they were sophomores in high school in 2004. And this reflects their progress as of 2013. This is national data. So we've drawn from the National Student Clearinghouse, which has a very good warehouse of data of students attending post-secondary institutions, public and private, anywhere in the country. And what we know, or what we're pretty confident about, is that only 22% of that high school class of 2006 has completed a bachelor's or advanced degree. We see another 5% in the associate's degree category, some certificates that aren't quite incorporated here. Some of that black bar is probably certificates, but we don't think it's much. A whole bunch of folks who did complete high school, and then, of course, 18%, too many who did not. Final point before I'll pause to see if there are questions is this final bar that I'm adding now to both the class of 2006, the pipeline, and the working age. This is the some college, no completion that I mentioned earlier, where Oregon really is unique, or not unique, but where we sort of rise to the top of the list in terms of states that we have a lot of students who are showing up in post-secondary institutions, but have not completed a certificate or degree. And the commission's emphasis on supporting those students to completion and creating investments and incentives to support really reflects the fact that we do appear to have a college-going push in the state, and to some extent a college-going culture in the state, but not yet to the extent that we need a college completion culture.
So 1 out of 6 Oregonians does not have a high school equivalency?
Mr. Chair, if we're talking about the...
The 18.
The younger, yes. So when we look at the class of 2006, more recent high school graduates, that's correct, 18%.
Okay, those are 21-year-olds or younger, or...
Mr. Chair, they're older than that today. So they were expected to graduate from high school in 2006. Yeah.
Oh,
so
okay.
They're actually
they're over 25.
26, 27, 28, somewhere in that range. And that's generally the view that we're trying to take of the pipeline when we're talking about college completion. It's, well, we'd love to think it will be 4 years after high school. But when we look at the age of students when they attain bachelor's degrees, it's not 22, and 22 is not the peak. Right. 23, 24, 25, 26. So we're looking to that high school class of 2006 to try to get a sense.
ESD equivalents usually happen in that 20 to 25 age range, don't they?
Mr. Chair, yes, I believe that is correct.
So I'm assuming those 18% are beyond that and probably aren't going to have a high school equivalency.
Taylor.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Monroe. So I have two questions. One is this private and public schools combined in Oregon?
Representative Taylor, Mr. Co-Chair, yes, it is.
Okay. And then follow up, the second question I have is, are you going to eventually show us the breakdown of the different schools for the green with the slash, the 35% of what the breakdown is for each of the seven public universities?
Representative Taylor, Mr. Co-Chair, I don't have that slide prepared, but we certainly have that data for our public institutions in Oregon, yes.
Go ahead. Thank you, Chair Monroe. So just maybe we won't hold you to this, but off the top of your head, are there certain schools where this is happening more than others, would you say? Where they enter and don't complete?
Representative Taylor, Mr. Co-Chair, it's a complicated question. Some significant percentage of the 18 and 35% that you're focused on, some percentage of that are students who did not perhaps intend to get a certificate or degree. That would be most likely true at a community college where a student shows up, may try a course, or may be trying to brush up on something workforce related that doesn't terminate in certificate or degree. So I want to make sure that I sort of start with that caveat. Mm-hmm. The greatest sort of likelihood of finding students in that bar is on a community college campus. I mean, that sort of by the nature of community colleges as access oriented institutions, that's where we find that we're most likely to find students who have some college but not a certificate or degree. At our public universities, the rates of completion vary a lot. Mm-hmm. They are, you know, as high as 80%+ and as low as 50%, depending on institution. And again, we'd be happy to provide that data.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we know the percentage of students who leave high school go to the military, and do they get credit for certificates earned in the military with respect to this particular?
Senator Roblin, Mr. Co-Chair, the certificate count that's included here, we've had to estimate it based on some national research of the percentage of adults who hold certificates. I would have to double check whether that estimate incorporated military certificates or training, military training that was reflected in some certificate. So I'm not certain. I believe that we could, although I don't, I'm not 100% certain, but I believe that we could provide an estimate of the number of Oregonians who transition from high school to the military within, okay, some period of time. There's a lot of data we could provide relative to trends on the charts that we've just looked at, but I'm just showing one, which is the percentage of adults with associate's degrees or higher. So now we've clustered all the degrees. We're not talking certificates or apprenticeship. Unfortunately, this data doesn't include that as well, so it's not truly the middle and upper 40 or the entirety. But just to look at some recent history, and the good news here is that the trend both for Oregon and the country is up. And partly this was a function of a down economy and a lot of Americans going back to or into higher education. Our growth rate here has been pretty fast. And in fact, today there are 48,000 more working age Oregonians who hold degrees than did in 2010. That's a big boost. But it's not swift enough to catch up with these very ambitious goals. And as I said, I think there are a lot of things responsible for it, but unquestionably the fact that jobs were not plentiful accounts for a significant increase, a significant portion of the increase both here and nationally.
Ben, I took a course in statistics one time. That graph is a perfect example of skewing statistics, because it doesn't start at zero, it starts at 35. And it makes it look like the growth has been pretty dramatic, but it's really only been between 37 and 40. I don't know. We just need to be careful how you read graphs. Sometimes they don't say what you want them to say.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, I certainly take the point. I will note that I was careful in putting this slide together to look at the error rate, the sort of margin of error around this data, because I think any time you're talking about percentage, you know, 1 or 2 percentage point changes, you want to be careful to ensure that isn't within just a margin of error. That's part of why I included the U.S. number here, too. I mean, both of the sort of margin of error here is pretty narrow. It's the entire adult population. It's a large sample. There has been an increase in the percentage of Oregonians, but you're correct. It's certainly not the sort of doubling that this line on its own would suggest. The middle 40, there was good work done by this legislature last year on the definition to the middle 40, adding registered apprenticeships, being sure that got called out. And the HEC, the OEIB, has endorsed a broad understanding of what counts for the middle 40, and I've listed here, I've mentioned a number of these, although not all of them. That broad definition, that sort of larger view of what should count for the middle 40, is part of what complicates the data analysis of our progress towards it, because again, some of these things are things that the state of Oregon really doesn't know except through our estimates via surveys or national data. So part of our challenge in giving a precise answer to the question of where the state stands on 40-40-20 is this broad conception of the middle 40, but it does seem important and useful for us to take that view. We're going to have a snapshot.
Yeah. Senator Roblin.
So with regard to the certificates that are produced at the community college, we could make that as part of their reporting to us. So we could get better on that part. And possibly apprenticeship programs, if we had a relationship, we could start getting that data in a form that could be more than a estimate. Is that true?
And Senator Roblin, Mr. Co-Chair, yes. And in fact, on community college issued certificates, we do have a pretty accurate count. Those are reported today to the state and will continue to be. Likewise, registered apprenticeships, I believe we have a firm count on that. The challenge being that those, as this slide reflects, are only a portion, a subset of that, the total middle 40. But you're correct. We do have that. You'll see a snapshot of institutions in a little bit, but before we got there, I wanted to just provide a snapshot of Oregon college students. What do they look like? And this is focused on undergraduates. Who are they? And just a few things that sort of jumped out at me as I looked at this data. I think the big takeaway is that these are not, I want to say these are not your parents' generation of college students. I mean, this is a demographic that is more diverse than it ever has been, that lives in a significant case not on campus, not in a four-year residential setting, that over a quarter of whom have dependent children, many of whom are employed, many of whom are employed full-time. And so you begin to get a sense of the sort of diversity of Oregon's current student body. And this is actually a subset that, if anything, skews more towards, because of the way the data was pulled, skews more towards the traditional population. If we were to take an even more expansive view, which the data didn't permit for some of these purposes, but if we were to include more of the students who show up at community colleges, for example, this data would be even less traditional if that didn't confuse you.
I'm interested in the statistic that it looks like nearly half of our students are working either part-time or full-time.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, that's right. And again, I think if anything, that underestimates the percentage of students who are working. But yes.
Senator Roblin.
You know, it would be interesting for me, just because of the funding sources, to look at that generation right after the Second World War when the GI Bill came into effect and see how it looked in comparison to this, mm-hmm. because I would say it might not be quite as different as one might think, just because there was a lot more people who had families, were doing other things, and were back in the deal. But I don't expect you to do that. Just thank you.
So I'm going to talk for a few minutes about budget, and obviously we're that is the purpose of these, you know, these 16 days of presentation. So just for now, some framing for you, the big picture. This, I think, is probably one of a few slides you'll see today, the likes of which a budget committee in Oregon may not have seen before, at least not quite in this way, because what we've done here is show the entire state general fund investment, general and lottery fund investment in higher education on a single chart. So you're looking at our support for colleges, for universities, OHSU, financial aid, debt service, and some other programs. We've compared the 13-15 to the GRB. We have some upcoming slides that also include the co-chair's recommendations for community colleges, public universities, and state financial aid. So I'll just asterisk here, this is GRB, not co-chairs in those categories. This is just general fund and lottery fund. If you have questions about any about what's included in these categories, I can certainly answer those, but we'll be obviously unpacking these over the course of the next few weeks. As you compare the two, a couple things probably to point out. First of all, in the governor's budget, significant increases in funding for financial aid, community colleges, and public universities. Those numbers in the latter two categories increase significantly more in the co-chair's budget. A significant increase in the governor's budget, and we presume in the co-chair's budget, in debt service. I say we presume because it's required, and that reflects the state investment commitments to our colleges and universities in recent years for capital. I think I'll leave it at that, knowing that, of course, we'll be spending a lot of time on these.
How do the private university students fit into this? I know they get many of them get some aid too.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. So the only way private university students directly are impacted here is in the financial aid category, where students attending essentially not-for-profit accredited Oregon institutions of higher education receive or may receive Oregon Opportunity Grants on this, our state need-based aid program, on the same sort of eligibility basis as other Oregonians. The commission's budget principles. So what you'll see in terms of our recommendations reflect a few key touch points. One really is 40-40-20. This is the organizing principle for the commission's recommendations that were brought to the governor and ultimately to you for consideration. So the strategic investments that we proposed, the focus on pathways and transitions, the integrated agency that you'll see reflected in our budget request, really is designed to leverage state resources to streamline, integrate in order to meet 40-40-20. Couple of other key priorities for the agency, sort of as for the commission in terms of the content of our budget, you'll see a significant emphasis on affordability, ensuring that Oregonians from all backgrounds have the opportunity to access, afford, and complete post-secondary education through targeted investments. And the largest proportional increase in the budget that we proposed was for the Opportunity Grant in order to help really maximize the state's impact on completion through investments in need-based aid and the making college more affordable. And the sort of final key sort of principle or priority for the commission as it considered budget recommendations to you was outcomes. It really coming back to that question of some college, no degree. How do we move those numbers? And affordability is certainly part of it. It's one of the reasons we know students start but don't complete. But there are other tools that the state has as well. And one of them is to increase investments in our institutions themselves. And so reinvesting in public colleges and universities with an intentional focus on improving student outcomes. You'll see, we'll sort of highlight for you ways in which the commission is considering changing how we distribute funding to our institutions. So once the legislature has made its appropriation, the commission is responsible for determining how to distribute it for colleges and universities and working in partnership with those institutions, we're developing new formulas that more intentionally support their work, not merely to enroll students, but to ensure that they complete. So creating incentives and rewards for them to do that. And there are other ways, and here you'll see this focus on outcomes emerge. Just sort of a placeholder for now, but we are proposing new key performance measures for your consideration and hopefully adoption. They're in several categories. They would replace, although many of them are similar to old key performance measures. We've been invited to present new key performance measures to you, and we've got plenty of additional information on those if or when you're interested. I want to spend a few minutes talking about governance, and then may want to turn it over to John and Greg. I'm just being cognizant of our timing here to talk about ROI. So we are in a new era of state relationship with higher education in Oregon, and the existence of the HEC helps to reflect that. Why a HEC? Why a Higher Education Coordinating Commission? Well, I believe it was the legislature's interest to have a commission that would provide a comprehensive view of education and training programs, including community colleges, public universities, private colleges, trade schools, financial aid, and workforce training. And we have a relationship, in some cases, a very significant relationship with each of those sectors. Here are the institutions with which we're connected at the hip. The commission is responsible in some respect for all of the categories of institutions on the left-hand side of this page. Again, another example of a slide that probably hasn't been presented before to the legislature, because we've attempted to capture here the students and the institutions that come under this larger higher education umbrella of the HEC. A lot of caveats around the data. Yep.
Senator Roblin.
I just want to know the difference between exempt and regulated in both categories.
Yeah. Senator Roblin, Mr. Co-Chair, so Oregon provides regulatory authority to the HEC. Oregon law provides regulatory authority to the HEC for essentially private institutions, both trade schools that are certificate granting. That's at the bottom sort of bottom line here, non-degree granting schools, as well as that's the second to bottom line, as well as the one that says degree granting schools. So we have a regulatory authority. Oregon law also creates exemptions to that regulatory authority. So your private, independent, historic independent college and university, and I actually use that word intentionally, historic, because in law, one of the bases for the exemption is a history of provision of education to Oregonians. So those colleges and universities, Willamette University is a good example, Lewis and Clark, Pacific, etc., are exempt. They're degree-granting institutions that, for all intents and purposes, are exempt from the HEC's regulatory authority. They do not require us to review their programs in order for them to continue to operate in Oregon. There are many other private institutions that are not exempt and do require the HEC's oversight, licensure, and sort of on an ongoing basis review in order to continue doing business in Oregon. And so that's the distinction on the state regulated and exempt. The same sort of regulation and exemption category applies on the distance education providers as well, who are located outside the state of Oregon, some of whom are exempt and others of whom are not. And could talk about the reasons for that.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just thank you, Ben, for all this. That's particularly interesting. Can you give me an example? You said you gave a couple examples of places where we do not regulate. Can you give us a couple examples where we do?
Yes, Representative Smith Warner, Mr. Co-Chair. So state-regulated private degree-granting institutions include Heald College, ITT Technical, the Art Institute of Portland, Berthingway College of Midwifery, New Hope Christian College. These are institutions that grant degrees, and in Oregon, to grant a degree, you have to come to the HEC. If you qualify for the exemption, then we say no more. We note that you meet the requirements and statute to receive the exemption. If you do not qualify for the exemption, then we review the programs and ultimately make a decision on whether or not you may offer a degree. I would, and you'll hear much more actually at the end on day 16 about our small staff unit that does this work. I would suggest that the primary rationale and the sort of primary thrust of the statutes associated with degree authorization is really consumer protection. That what the legislature intended, and a number of you have worked over the years on these statutes, but what the legislature intended was that students would be unlikely to get in a situation where their school is low quality, fiscally unstable, goes bankrupt, and they're out of luck. And that's part of the reason for the way the exemption was crafted, to say, look, these long-standing institutions are exempt, but others are not.
What about small private colleges like George Fox and Warner Pacific? Do you monitor them, or are they independent?
No, Mr. Co-Chair, they qualify for the exemption from the HECS oversight.
So they fall in with Willamette and Lewis and Clark and so on?
Absolutely, yes.
It's interesting to note that in Western Oregon, there's a pretty high percentage of our students that are actually attending a private university. I don't think of any private universities in Eastern Oregon, but they make up a pretty significant percentage in the Willamette Valley in particular.
And Mr. Co-Chair, that's true. And part of the reason for including the FTE counts on this slide was to give you the ability to start to think about where Oregon's student population attends. And obviously community colleges, or maybe not obviously, but probably obviously, the community colleges and public universities drive a lot of the attendance, but so too did, you know, you've got 35,000 full-time equivalents attending private degree-granting exempt institutions. So you're correct. That is a significant percentage of Oregon's student body.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chairman Rowe. Do you track which students, when they enter one of the universities or community colleges, are actually seeking a degree? So when they sign up, they say, I'm enrolling in a degree program versus just taking a class?
Representative Taylor, Mr. Co-Chair, the state does not. So we do not have data from our colleges and universities that flags whether a student is degree-seeking or not. And by and large, I believe that our community colleges and universities don't have that as well, although I may get corrected by some community colleges that are taking steps to try to help students identify their goals at the outset and maybe tracking that systematically. At the state level, we're not, and it's one of the challenges that we have relative to a real emphasis on completion. This question, well, is that what the student intends? I think at a public university, both the universities as well as the commission feel pretty confident saying most students who enroll as undergraduates in public universities intend to earn a bachelor's degree. There are very few who don't. Now, there are some exceptions to that. We have some associate's degree granting institutions. We have other reasons that adult Oregonians may enroll in courses, but most students intend a bachelor's degree. Community colleges, it's a lot more complicated. There's no question there are other motivations. With apologies to those who have walked through this before, and I'll do it in a pretty quick way, this slide or set of slides, it's animated, attempts to describe how our system governance has changed since 2013. So on the left-hand side, the page has two sides, or the slide does, and on the left-hand side is our old system, and then our new one will emerge. Starting with the institutions, so that's what I'm showing now, with in 2013, a state board of higher education with governance authority, the blue bars are the boards. So they were governing. They were responsible for really the oversight, hiring and firing, et cetera, of presidents of our seven public universities, and then 17 community colleges with their independently elected boards with governance authority. And at the state level, we had four or five, depending on how you count the State Board of Higher Ed, boards or commissions involved in the support for higher education. And that was, one of the challenges, or some would say problems, the legislature was dealing with in 2013 when we came up with what you'll see on the right-hand side. So each of those boards was supported by an agency from Oregon University System, which was, of course, in the process of not becoming an agency any longer, but still a significant staff there. OSAC, CCWD, the OEIB, we had these sort of discrete agencies and boards responsible for higher education in Oregon. So what we've done, we haven't changed anything, first of all, really important to note. There's nothing that's changed about the governance of our community colleges. They remain governed by independently elected, locally elected governing boards. But our university system, as you're well aware, has changed in several ways. One of them is the creation of institutional boards, state-appointed or governor-appointed, Senate-confirmed, but institutional boards. We started with, and ignore the OEIB for a minute, although we'll come back to the state side. We started with a institutional board overseeing the four regional and technical universities, really a carry-on of the State Board of Higher Ed. I'm just going to fast forward this so you see the final state. But here's where we end up. Seven institutional boards as of July of this year. All seven institutional boards for the universities will be in full effect. A shared service operation that they oversee through a kind of consortium agreement to provide for shared administrative services for the seven. And at the state level, really only two entities responsible for higher education. The HEC, which is combining then offices of OSAC, CCWD, and its own staff into a single sort of post-secondary support structure, and the OEIB, in however that is defined going forward by this legislature.
Speaking of which, the OEIB sunsets this year. We're going to be asked to extend that sunset or change that in some way or to allow it to expire. I'd like to have your opinion on the function and the necessity of having the OEIB when we have a HEC and when we have now independent boards for the three big universities and an independent board basically to cover the small universities as well. A question this subcommittee is going to have to answer, and so I need your help.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Monroe, so I want to first sort of again draw attention to the significant consolidation and streamlining that's occurred at the state level around our supports and boards involved in the oversight of post-secondary education. And I think that what we have now, a HEC and an OEIB, reflects a lot of progress in that regard since 2013. In terms of the OEIB specifically, I want to talk about function, and I'll answer it in that way. In my view, there has been and would be, continue to be, tremendous value in an organization at the state that is responsible for the P20 oversight and direction, particularly for the emphasis that it can create around the transitions. And I guess one way to illustrate this, it became very clear to me when I moved into my current role that if not for a chief education officer, if not for Nancy Golden and a board that was focused on that grade 11 through 14 transition, it would be very easy. In fact, it may be natural for me and our deputy superintendent, Rob Saxton, not to meet. We would get sort of sucked. You see the way in which your focus and your energy and your incentives become very sector oriented. I would spend, just to put it very bluntly, I would spend all of my time with the colleges and the universities and higher ed. And what a P20 structure does is force me to really think about K-12 and to sit down with Rob and my staff, to sit down with his staff and work on that, those questions of alignment and transition. I believe that likewise it does that around the early learning and K-12 gap. So, obviously the question of what structure that P20 leadership and direction takes is yours to resolve. But having it there, having a higher authority, if you will, that really is P20 focused, I think is incredibly valuable. And in fact, long before there was an OEIB, there were a lot of attempts by this, by the legislature, to build that somehow. And we've tried a lot of things. When I became education policy advisor for the governor, I couldn't believe how many statutes there were that called on the education policy of the advisor of the governor to do P20 things, because nobody else could, you couldn't figure out where else to put it, mm-hmm. right? See, there wasn't a chief education officer, there wasn't an OEIB, but we wanted a Minority Teacher Act report that involved our colleges of education and K-12 working together and TSPC. And who was going to do that? Well, I guess we'll ask the governor's office to do it. So I think there has for a very long time been a need, and I think OEIB and chief education officer reflect and respond to that, and I think it's a important thing to find a way to continue to deliver.
So, for example, questions involving dual credit classes between high school juniors and seniors and community colleges or universities, those kind of questions, it's necessary to have this structure to resolve?
Senator Monroe, yes, it is necessary to have a structure that can deal with that. I absolutely think that's one of several examples of these overlapping issues that can be dealt with more systemically and holistically through some sort of P20 oversight entity.
Okay, thank you.
I want to finish for today and make sure that Greg and John have some opportunity to talk about return on investment for higher education, but let me just note a few things about the governance structure. I've sort of highlighted this already, but worth pointing out again that we did create new institutional governing boards for all of our public universities. We did maintain existing local governing boards at our community colleges. We went from 5 state boards to 2. We have now a single state agency with responsibility for all sectors of higher education, public and private. And that state agency, the HEC, has a clearly defined focus on coordination, not governance. So we're not in the business of telling institutions how to operate. We are, however, responsible for advising and exercising our responsibilities with a real emphasis on the coordination of the system.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chairman Rowe. So when OUS existed, what happened when you dismantled and everyone went through a separate way? What happened to all the data and all the information that was collected by the research team there? There was a lot of work for several decades.
Representative Taylor, Mr. Kutcher, a very important question. And because you're right, OUS institutional research has significant capacity and significant expertise and a lot of historical data. And as you will see when we look at the agency budget request, we are requesting the essentially continued funding for the majority of that office to continue operating, but within the HEC. That actually was the path to that was laid by the last legislature when it designated some resources that had originally been appropriated to OUS for institutional research, it transitioned those to the HEC. We now have, as a result of that funding, we now have OUS institutional research staff on contract with the HEC, and we are in the process of preparing for some of that staff to transition to join our agency along with their student data system to join our agency in July.
Follow-up. Thank you, Chairman Rowe. Thank you for clarifying that, because it would be a shame to have all of that information, and I'm not sure we would really understand, the legislature would really understand what progress we're making unless this data is being collected and managed at the level, at bringing all the community colleges and the universities together. So thank you for thinking that through. Also, thank you so much, Ben, for all of your hard work on this. I know that you put your heart and soul into this every day, so I appreciate it. Going back to my question regarding the determining whether or not students are enrolled to get a degree, it is my understanding that there are several state university systems that do collect the data that way. I don't know for a fact, but I believe the state of Wisconsin does it that way, where they say, are you here to get a degree or are you here to take a class? And then they track the data from that point forward. I hate to see our universities and our community colleges not look as good, if you will, because it looks like people aren't graduating, people aren't completing things, things aren't happening, when maybe someone just wanted to learn French and they had no interest in getting a degree. And so I was just wondering, is there going to be, now that you're doing all these transitions, will you be tracking it this way going forward, whether or not someone's going to be coming for a degree versus taking a class, or is that just too cumbersome to do?
Representative Taylor, Mr. Kuchet, I think it's another really important question, and I'd be happy to follow up with you about the extent to which institutions in Oregon may already be doing some of this, as well as sort of our thoughts on the extent to which the state ought to sort of lean into that effort. I agree that it certainly hampers the utility of the data not to know precisely what students want when they come. I would also note, though, especially at a community college, merely asking the question may not be, and getting the answer may not be as important as having the conversation, right? That in fact, there are a lot of students who come and they may not really know what. And I think that would be valuable. And then colleges, and many of them are doing this, that are having the conversation with the student about beginning to try to identify those goals, and agree that it's an important point of emphasis, and be happy to get back to you on it. So you have our commission adopted vision statement here. I won't read it. Sort of echoes some of what Tim says in his letter to you that I presented at the start. But we are focused not as a governing entity, but as a coordinating entity on opportunity and success for Oregonians beyond high school diploma. Our roles, and we've touched on some of this, but just to, if you're trying to sort of in a nutshell, well, what does the heck do? It doesn't govern, it coordinates. What are those responsibilities? And the bullet pointed list here gives you a sense of them. We do funding allocation, so, you know, follow the money, right? And our commission is responsible for taking the hundreds of millions of dollars that you appropriate for community colleges and public universities and determining how to allocate those to those respective institutions. So it's a significant authority that we'll talk more about the HEC's work on in a couple of days. We do program and degree approval. So if a college or university, public college or university in Oregon, wants to start a new degree program, they come to the HEC for approval. Typically, that's a pretty simple matter. These are very well vetted at a local level. Occasionally, there is conflict, and particularly in the public university realm where there's some competition for students, we have faced an instance when one institution wanted the program and another institution said, we don't want that program, and so the HEC has had to sort through that type of case. We're responsible for approving the mission statements of the public universities. So, again, we're not involved in governing them. We don't oversee their presidents or staff. But the legislature, when it set us up, said the state should not turn over full authority for setting the mission of the university to the independent board, that the state, via the HEC, should maintain that responsibility. So we're working with each of the seven on their mission statements and ultimately the approval of those. We've talked a little bit about our role in student consumer protection, especially with respect to the privates, where we have some pretty significant, the non-exempt privates, we have some pretty significant oversight authority there. Data and reporting, to Representative Taylor's question, I've said if we were to lose all this but keep the data and reporting piece in a systematic way, we'd still have a mission, we'd still have a role. That's really key because that's how we're able to do presentations like this, is through the collection of student data from our institutions, the analysis and the making recommendations based on it. The statute calls for us to really be in the developing strategies and recommendations around coordination for all of our for the entire higher education sector. So that's a much more open-ended, but has a lot to do, I think, with convening, not imposing. And finally, we do oversee our state's need-based aid and scholarship programs via our Office of Student Access and Completion. could include Aspire in here as well, which that office also oversees, and you'll hear more about that in a couple of days. We collaborate to advance a P16 education agenda with our education partners at ODE and OEIB, and we provide leadership support and connections to workforce development via CCWD and the Department of Employment. you know, I won't dwell on this, but I do think the comprehensive view of higher education that the HEC is responsible for taking, the focus on coordination, not governance, puts us in a unique position to really advise and add value, and that's what our budget tries to reflect. So with that, I want to, with the chair's permissions, suggest that you invite John Tapania and Greg Hammond to describe a little bit of their work and thinking around the value of investing in higher education. We have some slides on this. We may get to those or run through them quickly tomorrow, but in the meantime, since they're here, I'd encourage you to.
Okay, yeah, come on up. We've got a few more minutes, so. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Monroe and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Hayman. I'm the president of Lynn Benton Community College. I'm also a commissioner on the Oregon Quality Education Commission. And I'm here to talk to you a little bit, perhaps a little bit more anecdotally, about the returns that we receive by making an investment specifically in community college education, but much of this will also apply to a university education as well. Community colleges are a pathway from poverty to the middle class and a family wage. The bottom line for the community college is and always has been our communities and our students and their success. To that end, we provide those pathways that lead to degrees and certificates, hands-on job training, and we also serve as community centers and cultural hubs, especially in our rural communities. By focusing on student success, providing a multitude of pathways to help as many students as possible progress to their full potential, and in many cases, helping them with the support that they need to successfully navigate those pathways, we build not only a better future for them, but also for our communities and our state. The math associated with a return on investment is pretty clear, and I'm sure you've seen examples of that. But I want to quote a few. Community colleges do provide a long-term return on investment for us as taxpayers and for us as a state. Here's an example. This comes from the Economic Impact of Community Colleges document from the American Association of Community Colleges. For every $1 of public money invested in our community colleges, taxpayers receive a cumulative value of $6.80 over the course of that student's term and of employment. So you can see that a significant return on investment. The U.S. Census indicates that students who get a two-year degree earn 20% more every year than a student with just a high school diploma. The Oregon Education Investment Board has something called an equity lens, and it indicates that when we focus our resources on those who are most able to benefit from those, specifically those who start at the lower ends of the economic spectrum, we have the capacity to reap the greatest benefit of gain. Not only do we see those kinds of returns in terms of their own participation, but we also see a significant avoidance of other costs, for instance, in the form of reduced health care, reduced welfare, reduced unemployment, and reduced crime. It is estimated that the state saves $61.5 million per year as a result of that investment. I do want to give you an example. I'm going to talk to you about Philip. Philip, who is now 38, has been an inmate of the Oregon Corrections System for four different sentences for a total of 14 years. And he tells me that he would still be there if it weren't for what he found at our community college. He graduated from LBCC last year. He'll be graduating from Oregon State University this year as a result of our degree partnership program with them. With a degree in sociology, he's going to go on to graduate school, and his career will be helping other inmates make a successful and productive reentry into our communities. So from spending $38,000 a year to incarcerate him, we now have a student, a person, a citizen, who's making a significant contribution economically and culturally. That's the kind of return on investment that I think we all seek. I'll give you another real quick example. A woman named Coquille. Coquille left an abusive relationship, marriage, in which she was convinced that she was stupid. She graduated from our institution with honors, is at Oregon State University. She happened to discover that she has an exceptional gift in the area of physics and mathematics. Amazing. Amazing. And that doesn't even capture the opportunity, the value of a workforce that is smarter, more skilled, able to support the business expansion that we seek for our communities statewide. So restoring the budgets to restore our capacity to meet those needs is not just critical, but is a great investment in our future. I'll give you one example again in our area. We have actually a business-led venture called Really Original Workforce Investment Initiative, which brings together a cluster of businesses around manufacturing exotic metals technologies and adds to it the interest and investments of the city, the county, the community college, and area school districts in order to create the educated workforce that will fill what we believe will be an additional 1,000 jobs over the next 5 years. Working together, we're able to not just support those jobs, but to create the workforce that will fill those jobs. By investing now, we will share in those rewards later, and Oregon will be all the better for it. So I ask you to help us to build those pathways and support those students who will then be part of our future success. Thank you.
Greg, the co-chairs have recommended a community college budget of $535.
That's true.
Which is a little better than the last few years have been. But it still funds community colleges on an FTE basis without recognition that some programs cost more than other programs. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the most expensive programs are the ones that lead to the highest paying jobs. If we were able to find additional resources above the 535, it's been suggested we might look for another $15 million, for example, and get it up to 550.
Mm-hmm.
Would it make sense to distribute that money more to the higher paying, higher cost programs rather than just a straight across the board increase in FTE?
Co-Chair Monroe, that's a great question. It will get me in trouble answering it.
I've been around too long. I think about this stuff
too much. And you know me. So I am clearly an advocate for resources being more directly focused on the outcomes that we seek. And I think getting it right is important, and it's a challenge. Career technical programs are more costly to provide. They also require more hours of focused attention of our students, which makes it more difficult for them to do some of the other things that might make it possible for them to support themselves, for instance, in our welding program or our automotive technology program. They don't get to leave class and go off and do their job. They have to spend 5 hours, in that shop, learning those skills, hands-on practice over and over and over. That's time-consuming for them, and it's costly for us. Our institution has resorted to differential tuition so that students in career technical programs actually pay a higher tuition rate. We don't think that's a very good strategy, but at the moment it's the one that we have. I think if we could find strategies for the state and our community colleges to work together to make our career technical programs more, cost-effective, that would be a great thing for us to do in our future.
The medical field, obviously, is another area where I know our students at Mount Hood Community College, if they get admitted to one of our medical training programs, when they graduate, they've got a guaranteed good job, $50,000-$60,000 start. And it's always troubled me that we have to turn away so many applicants because those programs cost more, and so it costs us more as a college to provide them.
Yeah, very true. Thank you.
We need to make sure we get John on.
John.
I apologize. I have to leave. I'm sorry. Thanks.
For the record, I'm John Taponia, president of Echo Northwest, an Oregon-based consulting firm that's been in operation since 1974. I just have a few short slides and comments on the relationship between post-secondary education investments and the economy. I'm going to break this into sort of short-term versus long-term relationships to the economy, both very important. And I'll draw your attention first to a number of studies that have been coming out from various institutions. Echo Northwest has done a couple of studies for Oregon State University and OHSU. U of O has done their own study, as has PSU, looking at what I would call the short-term footprint of their institutions on the state of Oregon and on their local economies, and they are significant. If you think of footprint, imagine the institutions were to pay their faculty and all their staff with $2 bills. Where would you find those $2 bills over the course of the next 18 months or so? They would be filling up registers throughout the Willamette Valley, the state, et cetera. These institutions are very important to their local economies, and their health is very important to local economies. In addition to that, in the short term, these institutions act as traded sector economic actors, bringing money in from outside of the state of Oregon. Fresh money that then circulates through, people pay taxes on it, et cetera. Examples of that are all of the students that would come from out of state to attend institutions in Oregon are bringing tuition dollars, typically in excess of the cost of providing the service, and are funding positions throughout these institutions. These institutions are doing a high level of federal research and pulling money out of the federal treasury, bringing it to Oregon, and private research grants. And there's a host of important collaborations with business and business spinoffs. Nike, CH2M Hill, the Knight Cancer Challenge, et cetera. So those are all very important sort of near-term impacts that these institutions have in the economy. Now I'm going to turn a little bit and briefly just to a couple of slides on what matters even more in the long run with respect to higher education. This is a phenomenon, some would call it software is eating the world. It is looking across the bottom at the nature of work and how much skill is involved in it, and then the U shape is going up the scale is how much have those jobs grown or declined since 1980 to 2005, and that hollowing out in the middle is the hollowing out, the destruction of routine work by software, which has led Mark Andreessen, the founder of Netscape, to say software is eating the world. So increasingly, technology is eliminating opportunity. Bank tellers, drafters in architectural firms, grocery clerks, where now you can go through and do your own barcode scanning, et cetera. You can imagine all the different, many computational jobs, accountants with TurboTax, et cetera. Consequently, what you have is this job polarization. You have growth at the low end with jobs that haven't been replaced by technology, and growth in jobs at the high end where people are creating in technology and interacting with it. In essence, what economists would argue is that since 1980, the pace of technological advancement in the economy as a whole has outstripped our creation of skilled people to work and interact with that technology. So education has lost the race with technology from 1980 until the present time. That has generated wage charts that look like these, which is, this is the Portland region, but I could do this for other parts of the state and we would find similar things. These are in constant dollars if we go back to 1940 up through 1980. During that period of time, there were large investments in K-12 education, in post-secondary education. We were building community college campuses, essentially building the community college system. We had the GI Bill. We had relatively low-cost tuition and easy access, et cetera. Education and our production of skilled workers was roughly keeping pace with technological growth during that period of time. In 1980, coincident with that same chart that I just showed you, that started to fall apart. Technology continued its march and accelerated to some degree. Our ability to create skilled workers to match it fell off the pace. And consequently, what happened is that the college wage premium, those who had made it through and got their BAs and masters, et cetera, got a huge premium relative to those who did not. And an economist will tell you, when you see the price of something go up a lot, which we have with those with college degrees, we are producing too few of them. And so if there is a single chart that I would, out of this deck, that I would recommend you think about as you think about an investment in post-secondary education, this would be the one. Just one last chart that in part feeds the undersupply of high-skilled workers is one that you are familiar with, and I think you'll see variations of these in Mr. Cannon's future presentations. Which is the phenomenon in Oregon and across the United States over the course of the last 20 or 30 years. This is state and local appropriations per FTE, community college and university student, compared to net tuition per FTE. And you can see that essentially the lines have crossed. If we go back to 1988, much larger share of that cost being borne by state and local government appropriations relative to the students. And over time, that that has changed. Price is not the only factor, but price is certainly one of those factors that has reduced flow through the institutions and completion. So I will end it there, simply summing up to say there are both good short-term economic stimulus and community imperatives here, but also, as you recognize by having created the 40-40-20 goal, it is to sort of spur the economy in the decades to come.
Something happened in 1990 that has affected all of that. It was called Measure 5. And since that time, there's been a consistent decline in funding for education at all levels and for other state programs as well, because we shifted away from property taxes and didn't replace it with anything else. Oh, sorry, you got my little speech there. Senator Thompson.
I'll get mine in, too. We quit cutting timber.
Yeah, that happened as well. Okay, Madam Co-Chair, anything?
No.
We will see you all tomorrow, and we will be doing our work. We're adjourned.
7:50.
We're adjourned.